Welcome to Risk Revolution, a podcast series that examines all aspects of risk management in the life sciences industry. We'll talk to industry experts on best practices for identifying risk, assessing risk, measuring solutions, implementing solutions, and monitoring results. Here are your hosts, Nuala Callan, Valerie Mulholland, and Lori Richter.
Welcome back to Risk Revolution, the podcast where we explore quality, risk management, decision-making, and the very human behaviors that shape those items right across the life sciences. Well, this month we're back with our book club episode. We've been promising this for weeks, so I am glad we finally managed to get the three of us around the table. And sometimes the best ideas for improving risk management are not actually found in a guidance document or, God forbid, a risk assessment template. They come from psychology, leadership, conversation, decision science, and occasionally from a book that just makes you want to dismantle half of your risk management system all before lunch. Lunchtime. So this is our Risk Revolution Book Club special. Each of us has chosen a book that makes us stop, underline something, argue with the author, or rethink how we approach decisions. And later on, Val is going to have a lovely young lady from Takeda, Celeste Theberg, who has taken her dedication above and beyond and has created an in-company QRM book club, brilliantly named The Risky Reads. And Lori, are you a disciplined reader who takes all sorts of neat notes, or are you someone who buys three more books before finishing the first one, which is a bit like me?
Okay, so I'm both at times, but I actually do take notes. So I have the book right in front of me that I read for this, but I actually more focus on historical fiction and self-help books. That seems to be my area, but I do dabble in business books. And when I do, I have to take a lot of notes. So that's what you'll be having today. You'll get my notes and summaries from that. But yes, I'm quite diligent. I do not buy ahead because I don't like to have extra things in my house. I'm quite the minimalist. So thank you.
Okay, well, that's definitely not me. What about yourself, Val?
Yeah, I'm the person who buys and doesn't always get to read, you know, because I love book clubs. I'm a member of the same book club, normal book club, now regular book club, with the same 11 ladies for over 20 years. So a big shout out to my Ballinora book club friends. And just in case anyone's interested, we're currently reading Land, the new book by Maggie O'Farrell of Hamlet.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. And we know each other so long that, you know, you're wondering as you're reading it what this lady or that friend are going to think about it, you know, because you know how they think. And I think the best book club books are the ones that cause controversy and discussion and argument. And, you know, and the same is true in business. I think the best books make you pause, argue with yourself a little, argue with the authors, writing in the margins, as you were saying, Lori, and maybe even notice something about yourself that you'd stopped questioning, I think. So, yeah, I think we've got four books today. I think, have we? Well, I cheated. I brought two. I brought one very famous classic on how we think, and I have a reason for why I'm digging that one out of the archives. And then I bought a more recent read, which I think is quite a provocative book, kind of asked whether risk management has made decision making more complicated. So I'm dying to share my thoughts with you. But Nuala, why don't we start off with your one?
Yeah, so, well, of course, as I said, I've brought two as well, but this one is Surrounded by Idiots. I don't know if you can see it there, by Thomas Erickson. Now, it's a very provocative title, I will give you that. And I did actually end up buying this one on the way back from a very challenging team building session overseas. And it sang to me in the bookshop. I think he's deliberately, Erickson has this framing around idiots is deliberately provocative. And I guess it's more designed to land like it did with me as a frustrated reader rather than a HR professional. And that's how it ended up in my basket in the bookshop. But as listeners will know, I am always interested in culture and behaviours, and more of my work is working with global hybrid teams. And, my experience is, to a certain extent post-COVID, I thought that, you know, some of this was going to go away. But I think actually my experience of late is that it's embedded more and more into organizations, this concept of hybrid. So much so that people may even be in the same building and dial into the same Teams call and won't go to the trouble of finding a room to sit together. That's the worst kind of hybrid. And I'm finding that teams are becoming more and more siloed and inclined to stay in their own lane following all the workplace transformations that occurred post-COVID. And as a result of that, we're seeing a lot of challenges around, you know, teamwork and collaboration and innovation and just knowledge management, not getting out, people not knowing what the others are doing. And most of our Teams meetings have become this kind of project update type, you know, oh, well, Val, did you get your things done this week? Yes or no? And, oh, Nuala, how did you do? And they're not, you know, they're not set up to really make that connection, that personal connection. So I'm always on the lookout for ways to get teams to really engage in dialogue. And by that, I mean active listening and really trying to understand the other's viewpoint, almost as a source of curiosity, rather than I'm going to try and beat them and convince them to think in my way. And I suppose this book is really a kind of an extension of sorts of the DISC system, you know, that psychometric tool mm-hmm. that many of us would have taken at some point in our time. And in this case, Erikson uses colors, and he has red, yellow, green and blue colors instead of, you know, the DISC acronym that we see around dominance, influence, steadiness and conscientiousness. But if you want a full psychometric report and the rigor of that DISC questionnaire, go to the DISC system. But if you're interested in a kind of a heuristic mental shortcut as you're observing behaviors, you're not asking people to fill in questionnaires. It's as you're in meetings with people and you're observing body language and behaviors, it can be a little rule of thumb, a little shortcut for you to think, okay, I need to adjust my behaviors because they're very red or blue or green. And just the descriptions of how he goes into it. The red behavior chapter is entitled How to identify a real alpha and avoid getting in his way. So the red folks are those dominants. They equivocate to the dominants in the DISC system. For the yellow chapter, then it's how to recognize someone whose head is in the clouds and get them back to reality again. And I'm sure we've had a few of those on our teams over time. For the green folks, then it's why is change so difficult and how do I get around it? So again, it's that organizational change. And again, the work that I do around culture and behaviors is really organizational change work. And so many people, you know, as soon as you mention the word change, that, you know, they're backing away from you and the nervousness comes in. And then finally, the blue is in pursuit of perfection. So they're the real diligent, you know, the people who are kind of asking, where's the evidence for that? And what data are you using? And sorry, what's your reference? And which edition of that book is your reference from? We've certainly got a few of those. And we do need those in our risk assessments. But I guess the caveat here is that, as we all know, personality is much more fluid and contextual than four boxes can capture, either in the DISC system or in the color system. But it's an interesting read, just in terms of identifying some of those triggers. And for really, it's about empathy. This book is really genuinely useful in terms of how can you build empathy and adapt your behaviors to get the best out of the engagement that you're having with the other people. And it's not that you're being somehow disingenuous. It's like, if this is how they hear the world, then if you want to be heard, then it's best if you either slow down in the case of the yellows or, you know, get directly to the point in the case of the reds. And at least then you can know that your communication cues, you're likely to get your message across before you've lost them. So it's really an interesting thing. But, you know, as I say, there are the same constraints apply, you know, that, you know, you can't just There's the ideal that you're going to try and build teams that have this a holistic around the wheel concept. We don't always, particularly in science and engineering and technical folks, we don't always get that opportunity. So I liked it. It was a quick read. I think if you can park the title, the provocative title, Surrounded by Idiots, it's really that, you have to think about approaching their way of thinking rather than trying to nail down your own way of thinking. So that was my first book, and I did enjoy it. And there was some, some helpful little hints there when you're trying to build teams and build empathy within teams.
I love the title. I think I would have bought it just because of that.
Well, that's why I bought it.
Okay, see? I know you.
Yeah, I haven't read it either, but it is in my to-be-read pile because I did buy it. And if I'm completely transparent, I bought it for my husband one Christmas, but he didn't get the joke.
Oh, dear.
I never
Okay.
got a chance to read it myself. Anyway, there you go. Looking forward to it. What's your
Yeah.
recommended read, Laurie?
So mine is sorry, I'm still stuck on that. That is hilarious. I think you should read it and then just keep looking at him like across, like I'm talking to you.
Point at the
Yeah, just
cover.
mine is not as fun. I went with Upstream by Dan Heath, and I will preface this by saying I actually got to see him speak about the book at the PDA Southeast chapter session that I spoke at for quality risk management. It was a perfect book for that. Great opener. He was an excellent speaker. In fact, I would argue that my takeaway from this is if you're going to introduce a book like this, and I'll talk about it in more detail, I would follow up with someone actually doing something engaging, speaking about it, activities on how to integrate this into your work versus going, here, everybody read this on the leadership team. This is what we're going to be doing now. So that would be my takeaway from it. But let me talk about it a little bit. The idea here is he starts with a little story about how imagine you're, on the river, on this river, you're hanging out on the beach with your friend and you see this child flow down the river and you're like, oh my gosh, I have to save this child, right? You swim out there to try to, and then you start seeing more and more people just flowing down the river that need help and you're trying to get every one of them, but you can't because you can't save everybody. And at one point, your friend says, forget this. I'm walking upstream. And you say, why? And it's like, because I want to stop whatever's happening from getting these people thrown into the river that they can't swim in, right? So the idea is, how do you prevent things from happening before they happen so that you're not trying to fight the fire after the fire has already started? So it was a pretty gripping kind of story to get you thinking about how do I work upstream versus wait for the downstream effects. I thought that was great to kick off a risk management session. He talks about how we get blind to problems, we normalize issues in companies, we sort of work around the problem because we accept it, that it is what it is, and we create shortcuts and work around things. There's usually a lack of ownership. Then he starts to switch a little bit. The challenge I had with the book and why I'm struggling with it a little bit is there was quite a lot of anecdotal stories, which were great because it supported real events that have occurred that showed companies that are firefighting. There was just a lot of them, and you had to sort through that. So my advice to somebody, if you were to grab this book, is really take away the key pieces from it, sort through that table of contents, and take away the key messages around why are we doing this? What's the behavior? And the behavior is we normalize, we get stuck, we have tunnel vision, we focus on the problems in front of us, and we don't have time to think backwards and go, why are these problems even coming in the first place? And how do we start to be proactive? How do we think ahead? How do we strategically design our business to avoid these things? How do we design processes from the get-go that support the people so that the people don't have to shortcut and work around it? He really drives home systems thinking, which is really important. The challenge was that there was just so much of it. It probably could have been about a third of the size, the book. And you wouldn't be drowning in stories and case studies and such. It was a bit heavy in that area for me. The other challenge was I'm quite immersed in a proactive thinking way because we do risk management. This is why what brought us together as a group. And so for me, I was a little bit like, yeah, I know that, right? So where I think this book would be important is if you're in an organization that's young, it's already very reactive, maybe it's a little bit less mature in its culture, this would be a good book, I think, to drive home a basic point to start to shift that mindset. When you're 51 years old, perimenopausal and grouchy, you're probably a little bit like, I've been there, done that.
I'm
Tell me how
surrounded by
this is going to be
idiots.
different. Yeah. So I thought it was great. I did. And he, again, I think as a speaker with supporting presentations to drive home the points, I think it's a really good book. It's just, it's quite long. I think it'll lose people at some point and they'll miss the key messages. So I would have supporting working sessions, things like that, to really integrate these approaches into your business. That being said, I'll close out by saying he did have some really great key takeaways on how to shift that culture, which is really we should start celebrating people that prevent things from happening, people that are proactive thinkers. We tend to reward firefighting and the big project that solved the big crisis. How do we reward the people that are thinking ahead, going, hey, maybe we should have this process in place because we're worried about something happening downstream later. Like, let's reward that. Let's talk about KPIs, which we've talked about as a group. Are we measuring the reactive things where how many deviations did we have for this or how many corrective actions versus how effective were we with our change controls? How effective were we with implementing that corrective action? That kind of thing he really reinforced, and I thought that was really important. I'm just trying to think if there was a couple of other interesting points. Having people with an opened mindset, which I think goes back to Nuala, your point about the behaviors. I love reading about behaviors in business and how we react to things. You should encourage people to go, why does that keep happening? Why are we still doing that when it's not working for us? Stopping and thinking about that. I think sometimes we just get so busy. We're like, yeah, that's how this goes. But we just, yeah, you have to do it. It takes an hour out of your day. But, and sometimes new people are like, but that seems ineffective and inefficient. Why are we doing that? So we should capture and encourage that kind of thinking, that person that says, let's pause, and kind of figure that out. And then the last piece, I think, is to create clear ownership. He talked about how when people are not fully accountable for something, then we tend to kind of keep working around it because nobody's really having to take accountability for any failures or issues with it. And then the last piece he really, really drove home several times was to reward that prevention and that way of thinking. So I did think it was a good book overall. My advice would just be, again, pare it down to those key points and really integrate it to have working sessions with this kind of thing. I think there's really great things in here. I think if you just toss someone this and say, read it, and we're going to start doing this stuff, I don't think that's going to go anywhere. And I don't know that it's going to inspire anyone. But him as a speaker, quite inspiring, very energetic. It really drove home a lot of key points. So that would be my takeaway for this book.
Well, in terms of what I heard from you there, Laurie, I heard you being very red, which is like, get to the point, stick, give me the synopsis.
Well, perimenopause has made me red some days.
But listen, I love that whole concept around prevention rather than cure. And we've talked about that a lot on the pod, in other episodes. And I mean, even if it's only that you take some of the anecdotes that he had in the book and you build them into some team activities or team discussions of saying, well, what would you do in this case? Or, getting people to think, oh, that kind of snapping them out of their daily firefighting mode. And thinking about what we mean by prevention rather than trying to catch all the folks flowing down the river. Funny, the Reds, there's another nice little quote in the book, in the Erickson book that I was reading about the Reds, wanting to be groundbreakers and wanting to win. And one of the terms that I underlined was that Reds tend to think that only dead fish go with the flow. That
Big
if you have
swim
any bit
red.
of life in you at all, you're swimming upstream or whatever. So yeah, just another little analogy there with your river analogy. But look, anything that can help people think about prevention rather than cure, think
That's
about
right.
leading and proactive indicators rather than counting outcomes that have for the last quarter or the last month or whatever it is. I'm all for. What about you, Val?
Yeah, I haven't read that book now, but I'm intrigued because I think that's a discussion point for the future. The amount of times it comes up, how do you measure prevention? How do you measure QRM success and what is trying to prevent has never happened? I think we should talk about that. So I'll read that book first. I have read previous books by the Heath brothers, actually, because I know he wrote with his brother sometimes. There was one I read years ago when I started out training and making ideas stick. And if there's anybody trainers out there, I got a lot out of that book actually. So yeah. And he has a book about decision making as well, Decisive, I
He
think it's
has
called.
several, and he
Yeah,
was quite
yeah.
a good speaker. It was really interesting, and it
I
was
would
invigorating for the
say,
morning, you know.
yeah.
I would say too, we should have a topic about that because one of the phrases I use typically when I'm in a risk management type of discussion is, why must we always sink the Titanic first? And I always think about that because it's like if they had stopped and thought about what was happening there and actually put the right amount of life vests and the lifeboats and the pr protocol was followed or was created differently, it would have been a different outcome. But for some reason, as humans, we tend to go down this road of having to break something first, and then we go, oh, well, we learned from that, but then we break something again. So, like, I don't know how we have how to measure how what would the measure have been to say, hey, we should probably put the right number of life jackets and things in there because what they wanted to do was save time and they needed to reduce the weight, right? So, like, you know, I don't know how we rectify that in our head because for some reason it's human behavior, I think, to think this way first. So we have to
We
change
should
that.
talk about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Yeah, but
definitely.
again, it's a matter of priorities. We do I we absolutely have to have a conversation in the fall on the whole idea of this, how do we measure prevention? But it's a matter of priorities. You know, you can be sure they weren't cutting back on the number of cases of champagne they were bringing on to I
the
know.
Titanic in
I
order to
know.
bring down the weight. But obviously, you know, somebody made a decision that that'll be enough. Okay, well, listen, we better move along in terms of your book, Val. Where are we on you? My first book. So my first choice isn't exactly an obscure little title I found in a secondhand bookshop. It is a classic. It's Daniel Kahneman's Thinking Fast and Slow. Not an easy read. Now, I'll have to say it's a bit of a textbook, but it is hugely influential, endlessly cited. I know you two have already read it. It's almost compulsory reading for anyone interested in decision science, risk science, judging under uncertainty, etc. Just a bit of background. He was a psychologist. He passed away there recently. But his work, much of it with his sparring partner, Amos Tversky, he had a huge impact on economics, you know, and the thinking involved behind decision making. And he won the Nobel Prize in 2002 for that work. So his argument and his body of work is very relevant to those of us who work in risk. But the book is best known for describing two modes of thinking, System One and System Two. System One is that fast, intuitive, automatic thinking. It is the part of our thinking that recognizes patterns, draws on experience, gives us, you know, an immediate answer. It's quick. It's the mode of thinking that shows up with us at most of our meetings, particularly when we're under pressure. Now, it's not bad thinking. In fact, you know, we rely on it constantly, and sometimes that kind of intuitive thinking often recognizes problems before we can fully explain why there's a problem or even articulate the problem, but we just know intuitively there's something wrong. So that can be very valuable. But System One likes speed, it likes familiarity, it likes a tidy explanation. So it fills in the gaps, it jumps to conclusions, it answers an easier question than the really difficult one that's in front of you. And sometimes it even presents an answer with way more confidence that the evidence may justify. That might sound familiar. I'll come back to that in a minute. System Two then is slower, more deliberate, more thoughtful. It's the kind of thinking that I think we like to think we engage in as scientists, you know, the one that checks the logic, checks the calculation, double checks the evidence. But unfortunately, System Two takes time and a lot of cognitive energy, so it often doesn't come to the meeting. Now, the reason the book remains so useful for decision makers is it kind of gives us a vocabulary for recognizing what might be happening when we're making decisions or doing risk assessments or scoring and the logic we're applying, or sometimes the lack of it. So recognizing those two ways of thinking, when you learn about them, you start to see them and you see the biases behind them. So it really is a really good read. But the reason I've resurrected it relates to a fascinating new paper I came across in recent weeks from two researchers from the Wharton School, Stephen Shaw and Gideon Nave. And this paper, which I'll put in the show notes, they ask whether Kahneman's two systems are still enough to describe how we think in the age of generative AI. And they are actually proposing a third system, system three, right, which they call artificial cognition. So, in other words, system one and system two are internal to the human mind, but system three sits outside it. It's external, it's automated, it searches, synthesizes, generates opinions, and gives us an answer at extraordinary speed. And as we know, because we're all dabbling and using AI, it's very, very helpful. And it can support system two by helping us to gather information more quickly and compare our alternatives and identify contradictions. But that is what these authors describe as cognitive offloading. In other words, we're offloading part of the task, searching for the information or comparing the alternatives. But we are still cognitively on charge, right? So we're still on charge of the question and the output and the judgment we're about to make. And then they introduce something called cognitive surrender, which is where we adopt AI without the scrutiny. Where it does all the reasoning for us, it's substituting for our own reasoning. And they did some experiments, which is the attractive and interesting part of this paper. So when the AI gave the correct answer, sure, we were all happy clammy. But when the AI gave the wrong answer, we might expect that, overall performance declined in the operation, which it did, but it actually fell below the bar of how we might have done without AI at all. Okay, so it's really sending us backwards. And they proved this experimentally. So I think that this is why I resurrected the book, because, we're leaning towards AI, we're going to, use it more and more to help us with our decision making. We do need, at this inflection point, I think it's a good time to go back to Kahneman's work and have another reread of it, because, we shouldn't reject system one or system two or even now system three. The important thing is, though, that we know what system is doing the thinking and which system is doing the judging. And that's the difference between, I think, asking AI to help us and asking AI to do our thinking for us. So I'm putting this out there as a pre-read to all this AI stuff. So that's my first recommendation. You guys have read it, haven't
Brilliant.
you?
Yes. Yes, but I have not read this article and I am
Time to
fascinated.
read the article.
As you were describing system three, I actually was like, sir, I obviously have grown cynical in my age. But I was immediately thinking when you said cognitive offloading part of the task, I'm like, really? Or is it 100%? And then you said system four. And then I wanted to cry. So I'm very interested in this article. I will be definitely reading that.
We'll share it. I'll share it in the show notes.
Brilliant. And given what we heard this week in the news on AI going rogue and managing to get out of its own sandbox, because it became hyper focused on finding the solution, which happened to be in somebody else's company, but there we go. Yeah, I think it is a really good inflection point. I'm dying to read that as well at the moment. But let's move on, Val. Obviously, all this talk of book clubs, it sometimes sounds so formal. But how tell us how Celeste and her Risky Reads group have utilized this concept as a means of training, really.
Yes, so I was fascinated by this. So I sat down and chatted with a lovely young lady called Celeste Theberg. She's a quality risk management and compliance manager in Takeda. And she's a founder member of a book club, in-company book club called the Risky Reads Book Club. And the purpose of it is to build kind of QRM capability and culture within the organization. I thought it was a great idea. I sat down to hear how it started and what Celeste has learned from running it.
So let's have a listen.
So I'm delighted to welcome Celeste Thaberg to the podcast. Celeste is the Quality Risk Management and Compliance Program Manager at Takeda. But the reason we invited Celeste onto the program is she has done something really, really interesting. She started a book club in her company, and the book club is focused on learning more about quality risk management, developing discussions and knowledge around QRM. And wait for it, it's got a great name, the Risky Reads Book Club. So we were really interested in talking to Celeste, learning how the book club works, and just seeing whether this is an idea that other companies could roll out. So you're very welcome to the pod, Celeste.
Thank you so much, Val, for having me. I'm really excited to be here as a fellow listener myself, and can't wait to jump into our conversation today.
Well, that's just great, Celeste. You're very, very welcome. So first of all, if I could just ask you a little bit about your own background in quality risk management, because I know this was part of your motivation for starting the book club in the first place.
Yeah, so I started my career working in the lab right out of college. I was working in a QC microbiology and environmental monitoring lab as a technician. After a few years from there, I jumped into the quality systems world where I was an investigator working on deviations and lab investigations. And then from there, I joined what I thought at the time was my dream job, working in quality assurance and compliance with a focus in inspection management. I got to plan, help execute external regulatory inspections, and then help with our self-inspection program. And then a role on our team opened up in quality risk management. And it's funny because at the time, I didn't know much about quality risk management. I had been involved in risk assessment once as an SME during an FMEA. But other than that, I didn't really know much, to be honest. My manager really encouraged me to take this new opportunity. She thought it'd be a really great connection with my previous facilitation skills as an investigator, and be able to bridge that gap between the reactive investigation portion and then the proactive side of hazard identification that quality risk management provides. And that got me really excited to think about the opportunities that quality risk management can provide with a proactive approach. So when I jumped into this new role, I quickly realized that learning about quality risk management is not easy. And it's something that you can't learn overnight and suddenly, you know, become an expert in. And as I started to learn more about QRM, I realized that other colleagues also had a want and a need outside of quality even to learn about quality risk management. And that realization is kind of what ultimately led me to kind of create this idea for the book club.
That's I'm in awe that now maybe QRM is your dream job. But that idea of using a book club to promote learning, including your own learning, is inspired. So I'll come back to that in a minute. But just let me get my head around the practicalities first. How many people are involved? From what parts of the company? How often do you meet? Tell me.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, our book club is called the Risky Reads Book Club, and it really began as a group of colleagues from the manufacturing site that I work at within Takeda. I really wanted a fun way to help build and foster a QRM culture at our site. So today, we now have about 30 members that are on our distribution list, and we usually see about 10 to 15 of those members actively participating in each session. And what I really love about the group is that it's really cross-functional. We have colleagues joining from our manufacturing groups, engineering, quality assurance, supply chain, manufacturing science, quality control. And recently, we've even started seeing colleagues from other sites joining and from our global teams joining our group. So it's been really exciting to expand beyond our manufacturing site. And we meet typically for every other month for an hour. And we have a hybrid approach offering in-person and remote call-in options.
Lovely, lovely. But I'm sure the donuts are in the room.
Yeah.
And the cross-functional bit is so important, I think, because that is how QRM is supposed to operate. I know so far you've been making your way through one particular book, and it's probably a book that everybody involved in QRM should read as a baseline guide. It's Quality Risk Management, a Practical Guide, written by Amanda Macfarlane and James Vesper. And we've reviewed this book previously on Risk Revolution because we regard it as a very foundational starting point for understanding QRM. It's almost like a textbook for the discipline, but it is quite a textbook. So how have you been orchestrating your way through the book? I think you broke it down by chapter, right?
Yes, that is right. So we've been working our way through the book chapter by chapter. And, with time being more and more valuable these days and difficult to come by, I wanted to find a realistic way to make pre-work manageable for colleagues to complete. So typically, each session, we will focus in on one chapter specifically and pair it with a complementary audio component, such as a video or a podcast episode. And that way, even if colleagues don't have time to sit down and do the reading, they can at least listen to the material while driving into work or taking a walk with their dog or multitasking with some other task. And then during our meetings, I like to start with a fun topic-related icebreaker question. That way, everyone gets to know each other and gets to dive into the topic. And then we follow with a brief recap of the pre-work materials. And then I'll typically facilitate an activity that colleagues can use to apply the skills from the pre-work reading and listening and connect those concepts that we've learned into an activity rather than just, sitting there talking about it.
That sounds like so much fun. And I hope our podcast is providing some fuel for your
Yes, of
discussions.
course.
But where have you found the most discussion points so far? Or was there anything about the discussion so far that kind of surprised you?
Yes, we've had some really great discussions so far, especially around risk-based decision making and formality of risk assessment tool selection. At our site, we've now have a dedicated group of colleagues who are risk assessment facilitators and are trained in that special skill set. So we've been really working to create our QRM master plan of risk assessments and further establishing this facilitator group. So we've been intentionally working to move away from a mindset that all of our risk assessments have to be FMEAs. And I know that that's a hard mindset to shift as our industry focused for quite a long time that FMEs were this golden facilitation tool to use. And I know you've mentioned that on the podcast before.
Yes.
We've talked a lot about how risk assessments can use less complex or less formal tools when appropriate, things like comparison matrix, risk ranking and filtering, or even a risk-informed technical assessment. And that sparks some really thoughtful conversations with people to try and rework their brain's way of thinking. Another topic that, oh, sorry.
Just to interrupt you there, Celeste, sorry. What exactly the some of the tools you mentioned there I'm familiar with, but what is a risk-informed technical assessment? Is that a something specific to Takeda?
I think it's becoming industry-wide. I know at
Okay.
Takeda we are focusing on using it. It's a less formal or structured risk assessment that can be used when criticality, complexity, and uncertainty are relatively lower. And it's quite customizable, and there's no set structure or format like table that you must follow, but you still have to apply the basic foundational aspects of a risk assessment, such as formulating a risk question, identifying hazards, and determining the severity of the harm and the probability that the harm may occur. So it's kind of
Okay.
like a risk-informed technical assessment, but with a more structured QRM approach to it.
That sounds so interesting. Yeah, but that's why you have discussions. Let continue. I interrupted you. You are having lots of interesting discussion topics, you're telling me.
Another great topic that's generated a lot of discussion was the shift that we're seeing in the regulatory language around risk and QRM, especially since the revision of Annex 1 a few years ago. And, there's been a huge emphasis on the documenting, using documented scientific rationale for decisions you're making and identifying the risks within the manufacturing process and the impact to product quality and patient safety. And probably in one of our most recent sessions, it was most impactful, was around we focused in on bias and subjectivity in risk assessments. And we had a great discussion around different types of bias and how to recognize them in real time, which is a very relatable topic for everyone
Yes.
in everyday life. And one member in our group actually had a bit of a light bulb moment during our session, and she shared an experience from a recent risk assessment that she was participating in as an SME. And a well-trusted colleague of hers was offering their thoughts around severity scoring. And everyone in the room was simply agreeing with him. And I'm sure we've all been in a similar situation when the one person's speaking up and providing all of the answers. And, as we continued to discuss throughout the activity, she realized that what she was witnessing was, authority bias. This was a well-trusted SME, head of the department, had been working in the industry for a very long time. And the group was giving a lot of weight and value to his opinion without challenging or questioning what he was saying. And, she kind of realized that after when she was reflecting that that's what she had witnessed. And she was like, wow, I wish I had found a way or realized that at the time and found a way to kind of speak up or question what was going on. So it was great because those are the moments that make it really worth it for me as the facilitator and creator of this group is when colleagues can find those connections to their everyday lives, everyday work, and apply those into real life scenarios. So seeing those connections happen is really rewarding for me.
Yeah, because it's not just about learning, as you're saying it there. It's about awareness as well, isn't it? And funny you mentioned authority bias because I wrote about that recently on the Monday Mindsets. If anybody wants to look them up on LinkedIn, and I know then for one meeting you invited Amanda, one of the authors, to join you, and that must have been a big thrill and a big shout out to Amanda from the pod as well. How did that work out?
Yes, we were incredibly fortunate to have Amanda McFarland join us in person for one of our Risky Reads book club sessions. And she's just such a tremendous wealth of knowledge and an incredible industry expert and just such a lovely person to learn from. So we had a really fantastic discussion with her covering a wide range of topics, such as QRM maturity, common challenges organizations face when conducting risk assessments, shifts in regulatory expectations around QRM, and even talked about some emerging tools and approaches for conducting effective risk assessments. So it was a really engaging and valuable conversation for the group.
Well, Celeste, honestly, I'm so impressed, and it's just kind of brought home to me there are so many ways to learn and so many exciting ways to learn. They don't all have to be dry PowerPoint presentations. So, and to increase awareness as well and shared understanding, I think this is a great idea. So, finally, if you were to advise a company to follow in your footsteps, do you have some tips and learnings from your experience starting up this this great idea?
Most definitely. So my biggest piece of advice would be to start small within your local site, your local region, department, etc. You don't have to make it perfect at first and overly formal, and focus on making it fun, engaging, and interactive for colleagues who are attending. If people are having fun and learning something in a unique way that's different than every other meeting that they're sitting in, they're going to be much more likely to come back to future sessions.
Yes.
And another important learning that I've found is that communication, both before and after the sessions, is really important. So promoting the event ahead of time, trying to get colleagues from different functions to join, taking pictures during the session, sharing those through your company's different communication methods, such as SharePoint, Viva Engage, etc. It can really help create visibility and build momentum and spread interest beyond the core group of colleagues at the site within quality. And then honestly, if you have things you can offer, like incentives like food or snacks, that never hurts either. It's a simple way to help colleagues feel encouraged to participate in the sessions more welcoming.
Yeah, it's kind of scary what we'll all do for snacks, isn't it? But anyway, there you go. Celeste, thank you so much for coming on the pod and sharing those thoughts and insights with us. You really are a QRM champion. And I suspect we'll be hearing a lot more about you in future in this space. So well done and every success in your QRM career. Thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you so much, Val.
So, Laurie, what did you think of that?
I thought it was great. I was very interested in what was going on there. I love the fact that there's this book club internal to the company. I love this. And I actually think we should have the whole book club on sometime and just have a whole discussion around risk. That would be fantastic.
Yeah, for sure. I thought it was a lovely example of how to build culture by having these small, consistent practices rather than trying some razzle dazzle major campaign. Just getting people together and having that dialogue and having a moment where we're not just talking about the current issue at work. I really, really liked it. And again, anything that gets people together, even if it is virtual, is good in my book. And just, learning how colleagues and other functions interpret the same risk issue. I just thought it was marvelous. Thanks, Val, for finding Celeste and doing that interview with her.
No problem. Great advice there as well. Yeah. So look, the whole point of her book club is improving QRM. So look, my second book then is slightly more disruptive. The question this book asks is, have we made risk management more complicated than the decisions it supports? Can you see the book there? I'm holding it up
Deciding. Part of it.
for those of
Yeah.
us watching.
Deciding.
Yeah. So this is called Deciding by Roger Estelle and Grant Purdy. Oh God, it's admirably direct. Now, you're not going to find seven stage frameworks or promises to change your QRM and your whole organization before breakfast in this book, right? It's written by two guys, deep practical experience in risk management and assurance and decision making. They're New Zealanders. Grant Purdy was closely involved in the development of ISO 31000.
Oh,
Served
cool.
on loads of committees down under, senior roles in mining, insurance, services, finance. And Roger Estelle, then the other guy, spent 40 years working in quality assurance and governance and decision making, etc. Been on numerous committees, founding guy of the Society, New Zealand Society of Risk Management. I say this because these guys know their risk management, right? And maybe that is why they're so willing to question it. So I like this book. It's written in very plain language, unlike the other recommendation, which is a bit academically foggy. There's no assumptions here that the reader is a risk specialist or anything like that. It's speaking to people who have to make decisions, consequential decisions, and then explain them afterwards. That's really the reader of this book. Executives down to the floor, it doesn't matter. The practical advice is very strong. There were two kind of maybe standout chapters for me. One was a chapter on conversation in decision making, which I suppose I haven't thought enough about. It almost sounds too simple, but decisions are rarely made by a person sitting alone in an office with perfect information. They're usually formed through discussion. So they do talk about the quality of conversations and how they matter enormously to the direction of flow of the decision. I thought that was a great chapter, really made me think. And then they also place real emphasis on another chapter is dedicated to assumptions. Every decision has assumptions, and the problem is not that the assumptions exist, it's when they're silent and hidden, and the decision is made, and we haven't made those assumptions explicit so that they can be tested or monitored or challenged. So I found that a really helpful chapter as well. Very relevant to pharma quality systems because, we're often excellent at documenting our rationales and maybe less disciplined about recording what we had to believe to head in that direction. So it's a great book, a really good read, but the part I enjoyed most is Appendix C, right? So it's after the main read and it's called The Risk Management Milestone. No, Millstone. You see, there's one E changes everything there. Millstone. And oh yeah, the author is now having dispensed loads of practical and worthy advice through the book, right? Then use the appendix to have a pop at the whole risk management construct. And they pose a wonderful question. The question they ask is, if risk management is the answer, what is the question? And I love that because so often we begin with the process, you know, and we've an assessment underway and we've a tool and we've a team and we've scoring scales. And then afterwards, we're trying to shoehorn in what was the question? What was the decision we're actually trying to decide? And these guys question whether risk management has become too complicated, too detached from natural decision making. Remember, they had a whole chapter on conversation, and in some cases, too self-important. They ask whether it passes what they call the pub test. Could you afterwards explain the problem, the options, the uncertainties, and the reasoning to an intelligent colleague without dragging out a 5x5 matrix and a table and a spreadsheet, et cetera, because if the method is obscuring the decision rather than clarifying it, maybe something has gone wrong, you know? Yeah, I thought the book was quite provocative. And, you know, we talk about maturity and risk management, and we're developing maturity models. But these authors make us ask whether that too is a kind of a construct centered on the architecture of risk management rather than the competence of the decision making. You know, you can have a very impressive risk framework and still make poor decisions. So, yeah, it's an uncomfortable challenge in the book. And they're not suggesting that we should become reckless and abandon disciplined thinking, but they are asking whether we've added so much risk management machinery that we're kind of weakened our natural processes of decision making. So I was actually remember that lovely conversation you had, Laurie, in a previous episode with Joy Whitsett. Do you remember when she said she often just asked the questions in plain language, what are we worried about, you know? And that was coming back to me as I read this book, you know, because I do see weak decisions that are decorated with the finest of risk management machinery and architecture. Whereas the aim should be to improve the decision itself. So I'm recommending this book, the body of it for the practical advice, and Appendix C for the slightly provocative nature of it. So I hope you
I
all enjoy
love it.
it.
I'm already
Well,
hooked. I mean, I as you
yeah.
know, I get very frustrated with being a victim of the tool or the design of this giant Excel spreadsheet that we've paralyzed ourselves from being able to think because we naturally and inherently do this. We're not always good at it, but we inherently manage risk all day long. So when we've thrown these tools and constructs at it, we've sort of stopped ourselves as a human from doing something natural. So I love this. I'm hooked.
You're hooked.
Yeah,
Good, good,
I've already started clicking the links here, Val, to get it speeding its way to my Kindle. I'm heading on vacation this weekend, and I am looking forward to having a read of that. I've definitely got some work in the autumn coming up that I think it'll be re really relevant for. So yeah, I'm all in. Thanks for bringing that one to the table. So, just in terms of my last effort, and I'm still reading this one, so I don't know if you can see that. It's called The Talent Code, and it is by a guy called Daniel Coyle, and it says, "Greatness isn't born, it's grown." So I guess it's a counterfoil to the Colours, the I'm Surrounded by Idiots book by Thomas Erickson, where he's saying, well, you know, our personality is formed and that dictates how we operate. This book is something that I actually picked up because my youngest small person in the house here is profoundly dyslexic, very bright, very curious, but can't read. And so the whole concept of being able to grow talent rather than, you know, and overcome some of the challenges that we might be born with was something that brought me to this book. But actually, it's a really, really nice read. Again, I'm still reading it. He goes off and does all sorts of cutting edge re or re reporting on cutting edge research about, you know, really reframing that practice makes perfect. He really talks about, he goes down into the biology of it, but he says it's not the repetition that practice brings that makes perfect. He said it's that repetition under struggle for our brains builds myelin, which is a sheath around our neural circuits. And he says that myelin grows and strengthens when our neural circuits are fired. And circuits fire most when you're struggling or making mistakes and then having to correct them. So again, it comes back to this concept of learning, learning to learn, learning from our mistakes, and not just abandoning something because we're not good at it, but going back and then correcting what we... And he talks about this concept of deep practice, which again is another term that I really, really liked. But I kind of was tickled pink about this concept that greatness, talent isn't this gift, it's insulation on our neural circuits that is that brings the talent. It's not some innate gift that we got as we came into the world. So he claims that this practice makes perfect, or practice makes, you know, our myelin strengthened. It's the brain is rewiring itself physically. It's not just memorizing the task or the skill that we're trying to perfect. It's actually a physical rewiring. And again, there's a lot of research going on in Alzheimer's research at the moment, not only trying to find, you know, a cure or a preventative medicine, but about how learning a new language, even, you know, in later years, can really help to get those brain synapses firing. And so coming back to this concept of deep practice, it means embracing the struggle, like not just, like we say, it's the opposite of effortless flow, he says. It's working at the edge of our ability. And he calls this his sweet spot, where if you fail and you notice the failure and you correct it and then you repeat it, that's how we build skills and competencies. And, you know, a lot of us have talked about the importance of building competencies and capabilities in organizations, such as decision making. And again, it's this concept of recognizing failure and valuing the lesson that failure can learn, so long as we go back and correct and repeat that. He also has these three golden rules for this concept of deep practice. And again, whether I'm talking about my dyslexic reader or trying to embed skills around continuous improvement and operational excellence into teams, particularly teams that are under pressure and teams that have a very structured SOP and protocol and methods that they're supposed to be following. And therefore, they're so rigid, like you said, in that process that we're looking at process over performance. So in this concept of breaking up the three golden rules, first of all, he says we should chunk it up, break the skill into small pieces, slow them right down, master each of them, and then reassemble them. And that reminded me a lot of training within industry, you know, the TWI concept that a lot of companies use, where they break down, they've got a visual, it's the folding the shirt, and it shows you exactly, you know, turn the left hand in and, you know, and then the right hand over and then turn. And it's that breaking it down into smaller activities in order to master each of them and then reassemble them. So that's the chunk it up rule. Then he says repeat it. And again, it's about one perfect rep is not as valuable as many sloppy ones. You know, it's that learning from that, perfecting that, learning from our mistakes. Oh, I could do it better here. And then last one is learning to feel it. It's developing that internal sense, almost like what we would refer to, I guess, colloquially as muscle memory, when a movement or thought is right. And you mentioned earlier in the Thinking Fast and Slow, also sensing that intuition when it's slightly not right, when it's slightly off, and being able to act when things are not right. And sometimes we can sense those things are not right, but we don't always follow up with the "and therefore act when something is not right." So I liked that. As I say, I'm still reading down through it. But he also talked about the importance of, particularly he went and looked at like soccer teams in Brazil. He looked at musicians in specialist orchestras, all sorts of things. But he says a kid seeing someone who looks like them succeed isn't just inspiration. It's the cue that activates the motivational fuel for years of grind. And I think we would hear that as "see it. I can see it, I can be it." And again, we want, that's why I'm all the time talking about getting our frontline people involved in these continual improvement and building up skills around that, so that it's not just a case that either, you know, the tech transfer or the MSAT team sweep in and fix the problem and then they're gone. We, you know, it's about building that capability to see when something is right and sense when something isn't right and have the skills to act on it. So it's just a short little book, but the last piece that he talks about is all about coaching. And again, because it's that mentoring piece and it's about teaching to the individual, not the group, and that mentors actively don't seek to correct the errors as they're happening. They're querying, how might you avoid it? They're asking you after you've, you know, after you've perhaps made the error, what might you do differently? What would you do differently next time? How might you improve on that? What would you correct in your preparation? Perhaps we talk about pre-mortems or pre-job briefs in the language of our knowledge management. So there's lots of little things that just resonated with me. And again, as a balance to the book, which is talking about the idiots, I really wanted to talk about, you know, the talent code, you know, and really greatness isn't born, it's grown. And I loved it. A light read again. Another airport read for me. So
you have to stop going through airports. You're just accumulating things as you go. I think that sounds very interesting. Do you know, as you were describing it there, that that idea of deep practice, was that what you called it?
Yeah.
I was struck by, since we met last, I missed the Knowledge Summit this year. I was gutted. Yeah. But I did go to a kind of an add-on I don't know, was it called a workshop? But it wasn't really a workshop, it was a think shop, but it was run by David Snowden of the Koonovan Framework Frame. But at that, he was, at one point he raised about AI, because that was the topic we were talking about, and how it might affect our thinking, etc. Was, you know, currently when you're on Google or whatever, and you're searching for something and you look for it, and then you get these answers and you consider them, and then you kind of, and that makes you think of something deeper or something else, you go, and we call it the rabbit hole, you know, but it's actually incremental curiosity and incremental thinking. And it brings you and your problem to places where you might not have gone otherwise. And he worries about AI from that point of view. You know, if you send the rabbit off and the rabbit comes back with all sorts of watches and Mad Hatter's caps and other baubles, you know, and you're trying to make sense of, you know, you are kind of missing a step of incremental curiosity. So, you know, I just was reminded of that when you were talking about that kind of incremental way of deepening and strengthening your skill sets as well. You know, that's a very interesting parallel there, actually.
Yeah.
Laurie had to go, Nuala, because... She's
on to another,
involved in a project.
Yes. Yeah. Understood. So I think it's time to wrap. And look, I think the message here is, don't leave that book on the shelf. You know, we saw from Celeste and the Risky Readers, read it with colleagues, discuss where you disagree, ask how the idea shows up in your work, turn at least one insight into a better conversation or a better decision or an opportunity to improve. We'd also love to hear what you guys are reading out there. So do send us the title of the book that has changed how you think about risk or quality or leadership or decision making or life in general. But do remember to tell us why. You can follow us on the Risk Revolution podcast on LinkedIn, and you'll find full episodes on YouTube and your usual podcast platform. And if this episode gave you an idea, or maybe you might want to argue with us a little, please do. Feel free to do that and share it with a colleague, subscribe and follow the show. Those small actions help attract some new listeners to find the podcast. So please do leave a comment or a review. We're always happy to hear that you agree with us, but in the true spirit of the book club and of this podcast, thoughtful disagreement is even better, and even disagreeing agreeably, as another famous podcast says regularly. Look, the show notes will include the four books and the Sean Nave paper on System 3, which I'm looking forward to, and Cognitive Surrender, which I'm definitely planning on doing on my vacation this year. All of the resources that were mentioned by Celeste as well. So thank you, Celeste, for joining us. And thank you to everyone for listening. Keep reading, keep questioning, and most importantly, keep improving the decisions behind that risk process. So it's a goodbye from me, Nuala, and
That's a goodbye from Laurie, who's gone, and a goodbye from me.